Yeah, do I detect a theme with this whole session? Yay, access. My name is Wendy. This is Sandy. So to keep us, you know, straight, we'll be doing a little tag team going back and forth with this presentation. Just as a really quick additional background on myself, I've been at University of Missouri, Kansas City, UMKC, for 15 years. I oversee the music cataloging projects. We have the MAR Sound Archive, which some of you have visited, has over 300,000 and growing every week, sound recordings, a lot of those things, very unique materials. And we talk about this later, but we got a grant to catalog the J. David Golden collection. So Sandy Rodriguez came from University of Kentucky to do that 3 years ago. She's now permanent. But just want to, yeah, so I'll be talking about the sexy stuff, and she'll be talking about the fun stuff. So if there's any one message we can kind of relay, is that providing bibliographic access is sexy and fun. Just go ye forth and be sexy and fun. And actually, it's near and dear to my heart. And of course, it's a case from the J. David Golden Collection of Transcription Discs at UMKC. Just as an outline, I'll be bipping through this pretty quickly because we do want to give a lot of time for some of the clips and things. I'll be talking about the importance of bibliographic access. We also have, you know, other access online listening that has already been demonstrated as being very important for what an item is. But bibliographic access also, minimally, is important, as are the importance of standards. I'll be introducing the J. David Golden Collection, and then Sandy will be going into the decisions and considerations for when you go out and be sexy and fun. And then we have some great examples from the collection, and then I'll be addressing some future issues. Well, the importance of bibliographic access, and again, I'm kind of preaching to the choir, and some of this might seem kind of dumbed down, but you know, I've had a lot of conversations sometimes with administrators. Why do you have to, you know, why do this? Well, here you go. One cannot always rely on lore or word of mouth. I have this great collection in my garage, or here's this thing of cassettes that's wonderful. Well, what's on them, who, what, et cetera. Bibliographic access democratizes information, so everybody can have access to it. Describes materials sufficiently to promote use. That's like 101 there. Accesses knowledge, even if not physically present with the item. So it used to be you had to pre-online, you'd had to go to the catalog or make an appointment with the archive, and sometimes it was a real problem. And then, of course, the main thing, connecting information to the seeker to the information they are seeking. And I have just a little story about the importance of access to bibliographic, what you're talking about. Just the invention of penicillin first came out in 1928, or at least that was when it was touted, the invention, and got a Pulitzer Prize? Yeah, Nobel Prize. Nobel Prize for that. So meanwhile, 100 years earlier, some little French guy had created, you know, a thesis about the discovery of penicillin, but nobody knew, you know, about this. There was no access to that information. So 100 years later, 100 years of people dying because there was no bibliographic access. So that's kind of it's important. The results of providing access, obviously, you all have had some products come out of this, but blogs, websites, databases, digital collections, library collections, articles, books, discographies. There's more to this. The importance of standards, we've already, you know, that's been talked about in some of the previous sessions. There's consistency in standards. What a concept, that's great. It's vetted usually if you have a more national standard, international standard, vetted by a larger group of users, and many times perpetually so. It's certainly more easily updated and transferred to other information platforms or programs instead of some homegrown kind of thing that doesn't deal with standards. It's cost effective so that everybody can share in that. And of course, then you're providing standardized access points, and we'll talk about some of the access points that we provided. Here's an example of what we call hidden collections. Now, the Golden Collection was, for all intents and purposes, hidden as to all of the content. Sandy will talk later, but there's a website that goes into like who was performing, et cetera, but it doesn't go into great, great detail. This was a survey that was taken for OCLC libraries. This was just last year, OCLC WorldCat libraries. And of the 128 institutions that they surveyed, 25 of them had some sort of online access. 7% had some offline, in other words, paper finding aids. And 36% had absolutely no bibliographic access whatsoever. So they really were hidden collections. And I will just say a lot of the grant funding institutions, that's what they're concentrating now on, are these hidden collections. So 60% of institutions are now using these sort of non-institutional funding to provide bibliographic access through grants and so forth. Well, here is J. Dave Golden. Then and now. Some of you may have met him. He's still alive. He's living in New York. This is him on the left, we think probably 1970s. This is him and his lovely wife Joyce on the right, and they came to visit last May to UMKC. And Golden had a career in radio and air advertising and operating engineer with NBC Mutual CBS Networks. He won a Grammy in 1981. Over the years, he amassed a collection of over 95,000 radio programs, and he continues to collect. What we have, he's got his own finding aid and so forth. Golden donated to UMKC approximately 10,000 16-inch transcription discs between 1995 and 2001. That's when he donated to us. That's not when these discs were created. They're mostly between broadcasts between 1935 and 1960. They're unified by the disc format, but hugely disparate in material type. So they include vinyl, shellac, glass, aluminum-based cellulose, nitrate, lacquers, cardboard, uncoated metal, electronically recorded, acoustically recorded, dubbings, and private recordings. There include syndicated radio programs, spot announcements, library service programs featuring science, history, children's shows, dramas, debates, a lot of variety shows, just a ton of things. So Sandy's going to be providing some clips to some of those things. And these are our re-sleeved 16-inch transcription discs at the Morris Sound Archive. Don't they look all neat? So some efforts that we did to provide access to this collection, we got a grant from the Mellon Foundation and began in January of 2008, and it was a three-year grant project. We hired a special project cataloger, Sandy, who is now permanent, thank goodness. We had three library information specialists, which is our lingo for the library support staff, and then we had two student assistant jobs. That we have a conservatory on the UMKC campus, and that's where we got our students. So our goal was to eliminate barriers for discovery by providing a description of each disc and its contents online. So we really were down to the granular item level, and we were able with the grant to really have an ideal situation with getting specific listening equipment and to be able to hire these students. So with that, I'll just turn this over to Sandy.
Okay, before I talk more about the project, I do want to briefly look at some decisions you have to make for any archival collection, and then look specifically at considerations for archival sound collections and how they inform those decisions and have an impact on the process of providing bibliographic access. And then we'll be looking at the project and using that to demonstrate some of those considerations. So I'm not going to have any MARC records up here, so I know you'll all be very disappointed. But I also do want to say, you know, a lot of this actually is kind of duplicative of some of the same issues in the ethnographic sound archives with confronting unpublished material. So I have this, you know, most of you are probably very familiar with the decisions you have to make. I have this up here to talk about what decisions we made for this collection. As Wendy said, we decided to go with item level description because, you know, the collection was so versatile. We had everything from personal home recordings to nationally syndicated radio programs. So we went that direction. And jumping down to delivery platform, we went with WorldCat because WorldCat has millions approaching a billion records. And we did use MARC as our structural standard and AACR2. And I have the EASA guidelines listed specifically here because they're incredibly helpful for unpublished recordings. They really were harmonized with the AACR2 and really speak to the unique nature of archival sound. So they're incredibly helpful. And then going to controlled vocabularies, we did use Library of Congress subject headings. And at the time we started this project, the genre form terms came out for the radio programs, television programs, and films. So we decided to go ahead and implement those as well. So these are the considerations. There are certainly more factors other than like format stability that inform the cataloging process, but definitely format stability does have an impact because with these archival sound collections, as you know, you have everything from relatively stable formats to highly fragile formats like DAT and lacquer discs, which we'll see that in a minute. And then available resources, obviously you want to have, you know, staff with specialized skills, playback equipment, if you're going to be embarking on any kind of preservation yourself, equipment for that, both physical and technical infrastructure. And I have context here all capitalized because this really is huge. Certainly knowing historical context is going to help you inform you for providing description for these items, but also how the item was manufactured and then the intent behind it. You know, when we get some recordings, government issued, wartime, you know, it's a drama. A lot of times turned out, you know, it's propaganda. And then finally, provenance. This particular, not just immediate source of acquisition, but this particular collection, a big part of it was from Pittsburgh. We got a lot of KDKA, WJAS, Pittsburgh recordings because a lot of that that collection had come from Bob Dixon, which you can probably talk to Steve Smolian about. And then available information, you're going to have, I think David Martinelli talked about, you know, having nothing and then having a lot of information. For us, we had a lot of nothing. so we had to do a lot of research. But I'll clarify a little bit more in a slide upcoming. We did actually have some information from our donor, which was very helpful. So we did a lot of collecting as well. And, you know, I have quality listed down here. Just, you know, we had to always keep in mind when you're transcribing from audio, it actually is very difficult. And we want to make sure that information we're getting is quality information. So this is our, now moving on to the project. It's a very straightforward, simple workflow. This doesn't include the preservation component. This is just the cataloging part. Retrieving should be simple, except we are what's basically the fourth floor of the library. That's where all the cataloging happened, and the MAR Sound Archive is on the ground floor. And then the students, we had students who would listen to the discs, and then staff would gather this diffuse data, and we'll look at what I'm talking about later. And we would create a basic descriptive record, and then I would review those records, enhance with subject headings, genre form terms, things like that, and upload to WorldCat. And then they would just be reshelved. And these two parts of the process are really the most time-consuming and expensive part of the process. which is why it was really great to have the funding to be able to do this from the Mellon Foundation. You can see the student in the left-hand side listening. We had two workstations, two students, the same setup, turntable, computers with the dual monitors. And then our end product is obviously a catalog record. This is how it looks in our local catalog. And then on the right-hand side, we did take on a cost share for the preservation component. And so you can see that we have someone cleaning, and then we have the access copy. They did keep copies, redundant copies on servers as well. So I don't know if some of you are very familiar with palmitic acid, but we did have a lot of metal-based lacquers that we had to address this issue with. We had some glass-based as well, and so we embarked on digitizing those as well. But with these, you know, it's very time-consuming because you do have to clean them. And it really did have an impact for the students, you know, knowing when to retrieve. You know, these were kind of interfiled with some vinyl. It was kind of a mess. And so they had to know when to retrieve, you know, the access copy. We had someone, again, they're on the ground floor. We're on the fourth floor. Somebody take pictures so that we didn't actually end up handling these discs at all. They took pictures of the label, if there was a label. And diffuse data. This is what we were talking about with Dave Golden. You can see in the upper left-hand side, this is actually from his website. He created a website that was really more focused on the content of the collection. And then on the bottom right-hand side, he had these half-sheet forms that really served a little more as an inventory of each item. And then, of course, we have the item itself and the labels. And I have two examples here. You can see one has a lot of descriptive information because it's, you know, a syndicated program, whereas the other one is an audio disc recording blank where somebody has just at least handwritten something. Oftentimes, we got nothing on it at all. And then we have what the students were able to collect. We kind of hedged our bets a little bit with we knew we had a lot of classical music, and so we hired music conservatory students because, you know, if you think about transcribing names, they're very familiar with composers, with, you know, Russian and Norwegian and names, but this didn't really help when it came to, like, excursions in science, this radio program, lots of scientists' names, so they had to do a lot of creative searching for us. And this is just a sampling of some of the online resources we were able to consult. The OTR community has actually been really wonderful resource for us. And then we did have some print resources. We used the OTR encyclopedia as well. So there's a lot of work that has to be done by just to provide access to these types of materials, especially with the unpublished recordings. And this is how it looks in our catalog. And just to demonstrate all the various sources that we used, you know, titles from audition, from, you know, episode title, from online an online source. Sometimes it was the donor would provide some information. We get additional information from audition. We would confirm dates, that kind of thing. So all of that was, all of that work that we did allowed us to provide all of these access points. And kind of the clunky thing with you know, if you think about the instantaneous cut recordings is, you know, they didn't have time to flip the discs, so often programs were separated on two separate discs, and then the other side would be something totally different. So you could certainly decide to catalog per side to make it less like, you know, here's a news program, you know, a subject heading for that, and then, oh, here's some popular music and variety show stuff. But it is going to be, you know, twice as many records and maybe take a little more time. So you're not supposed to actually be able to see what's printed on these labels. You can see there are Columbia reference recordings to varying levels of dirty here. But they are all New York Philharmonic Orchestra broadcast performances. And you can see, you know, if you think about, well, these were not meant to be distributed widely. So, you know, there wasn't a need to have consistency in title. And so, you know, we would, all of these would file under the New York Philharmonic, under the performer. If we wanted to provide a nice, consistent title browse, then we could go with a uniform title or something like that. And then just to further complicate it, here's yet another way, and this is published.
The orchestra changed its name.
Right,
the Philharmonic, yeah. Symphony and also the Philharmonic.
Right.
At different eras.
Yeah. And then this is a zoomed in, this is what we often got, nothing. And going back, you know, having to supply titles a lot of times, and using the OSSA guidelines again was very helpful in that. And then kind of what we've learned about all of this is, if you think about, this is a grant project, so we had a finite amount of time to complete it. And so, you know, we were kind of rush, hurry, get done with it. But we really didn't want to invest time in the beginning to get familiar with the collection, not just the contents, but the formats themselves. And then gathering helpful resources throughout the process. And, you know, we're very fortunate to have Chuck Haddix in the Mars Sound Archive to be able to refer to him. But also the OTR community and the ARS community has been really helpful to refer to. And then I have, again, kind of looking at the project, you know, the set parameters, because, you know, this stuff is very fascinating and you can get lost in researching it. And so we kind of have to remind ourselves, as people providing access to these recordings that, you know, we want to do enough to enable quality access point, enough research to do that, and then that will enable discovery so that the researchers can do the in-depth research. So we kind of stop ourselves a couple times. And then finally, evaluating our processes. We have another project, actually, for our KMBC radio collection that we're going to be working on, and we're certainly going to go in a little bit of a different direction with that one. Okay. So I wanted to have some examples. This group existed for 8 years, and there are very few recordings out there. This one, as far as I know, has not, the Roy Harris Third Symphony, the Great American Symphony, hasn't been released. You can see this beautiful label here. this is an example. It was actually taken direct, you know, captured from broadcast. So the sound, the fidelity isn't great, but it still exists as an artifact. Whoops. This program was a moderated panel discussions and debates program, and this particular, they usually included at least one conservative, at least one liberal, to get different perspectives, but this particular episode has Samuel B. Pettengill, who's a U.S. representative from Indiana, and Arthur Garfield Hayes, who was general counsel for the ACLU and was involved in a number of famous cases, including the Scopes trial, the Sacco Vanzetti case, and the Reichstag trial in Berlin. And what they're talking about, what they're debating here is, you know, what constitutes un-American activities and the committee that investigates them. This is a year before the 1947 Hollywood blacklist. And the first voice you'll hear is that of Arthur Garfield Hayes.
Well, isn't the business of finding illegal activities a business of the Department of Justice and the FBI and police departments?
It should be.
Then shouldn't any congressional committee be limited to finding out whether these police departments are doing their job?
Well, I think that would be a good activity for them to pursue, but I don't think they should be limited to that.
Do you know any definitions ever been made by un-American activities?
Yes.
Of un-American activities?
Yes.
By whom?
By the Brookings Institution.
And what do they call un-American activities?
I have it here. It's too long to read in my time.
Well, I should regard as un-American things like people being starved, unemployment, improper housing, improper treatment of GIs, improper treatment of minorities, Negroes, and people like that. I should regard all those things as un-American activities. And when I find people like you who are standing out for American principles and talking about un-American activities that attack unions, but shut your eyes and most of your publications to all the evils that are going on that I've mentioned, I'm just amazed.
Okay. So we have a music critic. We have a lot of his recordings, actually. He was a music critic for Philadelphia Evening Bulletin, panelist for the Texaco's Metropolitan Opera Quiz, wrote The Collectors, Verdi and Puccini. But before all of that was an aspiring tenor.
Tanto la vita, tanto la vita.
So you can maybe hear why he wasn't very successful in that. I'm going to go ahead and play this clip, but it's a story. And just to set it up, a man cheats on his wife after they argue, and he receives a surprise.
It was 3 weeks later that the present came, a present with a fancy medical name. He looked at himself and let out a roar, 'cause right where he looked was a great big sore.
Holy mackerel! How'd I get that? What is it?
He kept looking and looking for day after day, went crazy with worry till the sore went away. But a few weeks later, a second thing came with a longer and a fancier medical name. What he saw put a curl in his mustache, 'cause right on his face he saw a rash.
Holy mackerel, it's all over me. I'm covered with them.
There were spots on his neck and spots on his chest and a spot on his thigh 4 degrees to the west. He knew right away what his ailment was. He had what is known as
syphilis. I think I got syphilis.
Okay, well, this was a project, the VD Radio project, undertaken by Columbia University, actually. And the aim was to inform and encourage treatment for this growing trend of, you know, people contracting venereal diseases. And they used a number of genres to deliver this message, documentaries, spots, soap operas, and folk ballads. Many of them were written by Alan Lomax, actually. And then finally, this program highlighted naturalized American citizens. And this was an interview with Albert Einstein just after taking his naturalization test. And he does talk previous to this clip about what it means to be an American to him and how America is the land of opportunity. But if you look at the date and, you know, this particular interview question, you'd see how appropriate it is during the Manhattan Project.
How do you think the discoveries of science might be turned from man's own destruction to his advantage?
Science has provided the possibility of liberation for human beings from hard labor. But science itself is not a liberator. It creates means, not goals. Man should use them for reasonable goals. when the ideals of humanity are war and conquest, those tools become as dangerous as a razor in the hands of a child of three. We must not condemn man's inventiveness and patient conquest of the forces of nature because they are being used wrongly and destructively now. The fate of humanity is entirely dependent upon its moral development.
Yes, that's just a very small little snippet there to whet your appetite. Obviously, 10,000 discs, there are 10,000 stories, a lot for researchers to look into that had never really come to fore. I did want to say we do have copies of our PowerPoint handouts there by the door, so if anybody wishes to get one of those when they leave, that's certainly fine. Just want to talk about just a few things that we're going to do to address the future of this collection. We're thinking, you know, digitization of the content. We've had to do that to some things like the glass-based discs and so forth. To have a used copy in the library, will that ever go online? Well, you know, that depends on copyright issues and so forth. So, you know, perhaps in the future, we'll see. We do wish to have a more robust web presence. We do have a blog about this project, but, you know, we'd like something a little more permanent, and we have a few spots on our library website, but something a little more sustainable and robust. Also provide a written transcription of the verbal content. Maybe the lyrics to that VD song, who knows? But again, that would, you know, be contingent upon some copyright issues, but at least maybe we could have some sort of transcription paper so for people visiting the archive, and some sort of finding aid for that. And then we mentioned DAX several times through some of these presentations. DAX is Describing Archives, a content standard that was published by the Society of American Archivists several years ago. And so, yes, your very own ARSC committee from the cataloging committee, the subcommittee on DAX SR, which I'm a member, and I'm going to DASH to, well, maybe not DASH, but I'll get there eventually. But they're meeting as we speak, and so we've been hard at work for the last year or so working on some archive standards for sound collections, both the commercial and the published, and certainly the unpublished, as you can imagine. And here's some contact information for Sandy and myself, and we certainly welcome any comments or questions, or please, you know, check out what we've got cataloged. The bibliographic records, again, are available nationally, internationally on WorldCat, and there's some, as I said, some really exciting stuff. So I guess we have a few minutes for questions. Yes?
Andy?
We were able to, of the 10,000-ish discs, and we discovered a few more here and there, but that was for the whole three-year project, so that all of those discs were cataloged, bibliographically accessible. Now, Golden has some other discs he's got, and, you know, where he donates those, and, you know, there's some things at Library of Congress and so forth, so what we have, all of that has been made bibliographically accessible, and we listened to every single one of those and cleaned a lot of them and so forth.
Other questions?
Yes.
Sandy, do you want to?
We added actually 9,505 original records. The majority of it was maybe not unique. They just hadn't been cataloged yet because we did have a lot of syndicated programs on vinyl. But there were 154 that we were able, that had bibliographic records, and so we just were able to enhance those. And I do want to say, actually, we didn't really talk about the NACO work that we did, but there were a lot of scientists that weren't established, and when we did that program, Excursions in Science, we were able to establish a lot of names in the National Authority File. We actually established over 2,000 names as part of this project as well.
Anyone else?
Mr. Beal.
Probably those records that you found in OCLC that were at least similar, probably, right? Like maybe some of the commercial discs that he did on Radiola and, you know, would that possibly where you found some of the original cataloging?
I think most of the records that we used, that we enhanced, were these syndicated programs. Radio programs,
right.
Yeah.
Oh,
not
also had.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Sandy Hook, wasn't that his other label? I think.
The Sandy Crook.
I mean, no, yeah, right.
What is that? Yeah, yeah, we'll put a provenance note in there. Yeah, yeah. What happened? Steve, you had a question?
Well, it was about his record label, which was the impetus for him collecting the material to begin with.
Yes, true. Yeah.
And he selected things mm-hmm. from this collection to issue on that label, and it has, the label itself has one very unique feature, which is that each record label in the multiple number of records in the catalogs has its own unique design.
Right.
Yeah.
Because his first wife was the guy, the woman who did the pictorial, I think, things, the artwork, mm-hmm.
yeah.
and that was her contribution.
We found some really interesting thing. Well, you know, in the finding aids and sort, it depends on his concentration levels during the day or whatever. What would be put on those things? And of course, he has that website and the reference. And this was one of the big problems because people would access his website and there would be a number associated with, you know, whatever disc or program he was talking about. That was not the number he actually physically assigned to the disc and on his finding aid. So there, you know, so it was like, well, so we provided all of those. Every number that's associated with this disc is in the bibliographic record to be found somehow. Now, how we put them on our shelves was how it was written on, you know, the thing.
The forms.
And so, but we do have a cross-reference to his website. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, and depending, like I said, there sometimes the program information was very scant or it was inaccurate and a lot of fun.
Well, we're out of time, but...
and sexy, always.
We're out of time for this session, but thank you again to all of our presenters this afternoon. We've covered an awful lot of ground in the humble world of archives, and I think most importantly, we've learned that cataloging is sexy and fun and can save untold thousands upon thousands of needless deaths.
That's
so
also true.
Thank you all.
Thank
Have
you.
A good evening.